woke up this morning with the sun down shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
You talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Hello and welcome to Extraction Jack. I'm Tom Howe Ricardo on the board. SP Futures up 20, NASDAQ Futures up 75. We have Professor Kevin.
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
A little better these days.
Well, that's a good thing. You 100%?
No, but I'm getting there.
Are you taking your vitamins?
Yes.
Well, good. None of our moms are alive. We got to like be moms to each other or something.
My peppermint tea, you know.
There you go. That's it's a good thing. You're probably not drinking enough booze. I mean,
I'm not drinking any booze.
See, that could be the problem.
That could absolutely be the problem.
Everything in moderation, they say, including moderation.
Especially moderation.
Especially moderation. interesting. We have, like I said, the S&P futures up 21. NASDAQ futures up 78. Continue to creep up here, and I think we're probably going to, as long as we have this worldwide push into the of cash into the system. And when I think it's not usual for people to think in terms of the other side of the transaction. Are we increasing the value of the market, or are we decreasing the value of the dollar that the market is priced in? And it's not something people normally think about. Matter of fact, probably never think about.
It's on my mind every hour.
Yeah, I know. It's that, but you know, we continue to have, and I don't know what this means about the market, Kevin. We're a little nervous about the market, even though we probably have had. I'm going to say we've had, by being long the metals and finally those things coming in huge for us. When I say us, our clients, we probably had our best 2-3 month period in ever, especially the last couple of weeks. Because we were long the metals, and we actually got a few option positions. We got a little sneaky longer, and a couple of them have worked out for us. You know, real cheap ones that all of a sudden became not as cheap, which is nice. But I don't know. Maybe you can tell me. I mean, it's just as a person that kind of knows that people value stuff, and usually, you know, if people valuing stuff, they're kind of right. Everybody also knows that we do a lot of these. When I say for me and my clients, I do at least look at pretty much every earnings that comes out. And one of the things I do is, and this is not a strategy for anybody to do or anything, but don't do this on your own, is I look at the straddle, which is the, if a stock is trading at $80 and you look at the call and the put, the right to sell it at $80 and the right to buy it at $80, the combination of those two stocks, if you add them together, it gives you the market's perception on the size of the move. Well, you know, of course, it's their call. It's you know, or half of them should be less and half of them should be a little more, right? But usually, when I say usually, over my experience in the business, it's been very accurate. I mean, almost to the point where you who are these guys? You know, how are they so right all the time? But you also go through periods where it always comes in a little lower and you were better off being short the straddle, which of course, we never do for anybody. I mean, somebody could do if they had some huge account and they did it, but I'm not going to do it for them. You could also go long. Go long the straddle, which means that your time, you know, you want it to move more than the straddle, and there's the only risk there is what you paid for it, which could be a lot. But yesterday, two stacks came out. One of them was Lululemon, the other was DocuSign. And like, we had one in digital earlier in the week, not digital, Dollar General. Same thing happened. We put a spread on, thinking it was going to be somewhere within the straddle, and it doubled the straddle. Well, now yesterday, the straddle in Lululemon, I'm going to say, was $28. The stack is down $69.78. So the move is actually well more than double of what the market thought it was going to be. Now, DocuSign, the straddle is about $8. Stack's down 17. So these are all like little, they're not something you can trade on, Kevin, but they're just kind of little things that you go, I don't know if this stuff, if the market's got this stuff valued properly. As soon as they focus on something, it moves way more than, you know, some of them are up. And some of them, because we had Dollar General was way up the other day. It seems that, I don't know what's happening, but people's ability to price this stuff is a little odd. I mean, you look at the Tesla yesterday, it was down $56, but Musk fighting with Trump. Well, okay. I mean, obviously he's fighting with the president, but still, that's a pretty big move, Kevin. I mean, we're talking massive amounts of dollars. These companies have that many shares outstanding. When you start getting a move that's, I actually don't know how many, I'll find out how many shares Tesla has outstanding. When you start to have that kind of a move in market cap in like one day, you're going, wait a minute. And you see, like, NVIDIA will be up like $5 or something. There's 25 billion shares outstanding. I mean, we're talking, that move is more than what stocks used to, the biggest stocks used to be worth 15 years ago. It's becoming like funny money. I mean, there's nothing I can do about it except do well for my clients and be aware of it and make sure everybody's protected and try and make money on top of that. But for God's sake, it's getting weird. I mean, I don't know, you're not watching this stuff like I am, but what I'm telling you, does it sound weird to you?
It does sound weird to me, but, we move so much stuff on eyeball news information, and that there's no foundation for any of it, so.
Well, I mean, my Tesla moved $46 yesterday, 3.2 billion shares outstanding. What the hell is that, $175 billion market cap in one day? Because the guy's fighting with the president? Now, well, maybe it shouldn't be that high, maybe it shouldn't be that low. I'm not the guy to tell you how to price it, but really? Does anybody? I think we've totally lost track of how much money we're talking about with these places. I mean, when somebody says a company's worth, you know, $2 trillion, what does that even mean? I mean, where have you seen $2 trillion pile up? I mean, it seems like we're becoming the Weimar Republic. You see, you know, a significant portion of the population giving 15-cent coupons to the cashier, and the other people are tossing trillions of dollars around like they're candy. The whole mentality is weird. I mean, I listened to the Trump and Musk going at it yesterday, and one of the guys I saw it. They got these guys all these quotes in this article on CNBC. I think it might have been Ackman, but I'm not positive. One of the guys says, "Well, we should just nationalize his firm." We should do what? I mean, where do people come up with this crap, Kevin? Are they reading books from Mussolini or or Stalin or what? How do you take somebody's firm because he's fighting with the president? I mean,
well, first of all, you don't. But it's open season for any idiot. So,
I mean, is it just the fact that they all can get published now, or what is it? Were people always like this? Maybe they were. They just had no way to get it out there.
Yeah, that may be it. Is that the stupidest of all ideas has the forum now too.
Well, it was way too much work to actually get down to the town center and tack your thing up on the wall, right? It was too much effort. You had to write something. You had to walk down there. Now you just tweet out and you're good to go.
There you have it. And you know, if you're an expert.
Yeah. What do you think of the new soccer stadium going up in the South Loop, and we'll deal with the White Sox.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and there's a lot of moving pieces on it. So the soccer stadium itself, going up with private money. I have to see what private money really means, but it sounds like they're going to build their own stadium. The question is how much infrastructure dollars have to find their way in there, because that's the public money part, even though they don't really talk about that very much. So you have it. There's a little bit of an interesting history to the Chicago Fire soccer team, in that they're under new ownership in the last, I don't know, 7 years or so. So previous deals weren't that guy's deals, but nevertheless, they were, they are what they are, and for what they built in the suburbs. But they're playing to Soldier Field crowds now that are about the size of what would be appropriate for the stadium they're building, which is kind of interesting. So it could be an okay draw down there. It could be a good fit. But my initial question is, does that crowd out the White Sox, who had designs on going there? And then what will the White Sox do next?
Well, my I think that, the weird part is I've learned this from you. But mostly you. When Kevin used to write for the Irish Eyes and other places for sports, he would always, he'd throw through an idea, maybe an opinion, but the rest of the article, he'd kind of let you know the history and where he's coming from on the opinion. How does anybody tout of Sox Stadium right now without giving the history of the current place and how much the taxpayers are still on the hook and how minimal rent the Sox have paid? Isn't it?
Well, I think that's a big part of the equation. I think the people from the city and the state understand that and are not especially excited about the idea of doing something for the White Sox. Plus, they're just, much like with the Bears, there's not a lot of money there for them to, budget-wise, for them to do anything. So, and the Bears are, more valuable than the White Sox are. So I don't know what's going to happen with the White Sox, other than they announced their succession planning. They announced that yesterday, and that's
some sort of a succession plan.
It keeps Reinsdorf in control for 5 years, 9 years, 10 years. It's all kind of variable there. Now they've probably scoped out all kinds of things like pricing for it and all that as part of it, because the I can't remember the family name that they bought into it a long time ago. They passed on buying the Minnesota Twins in favor of doing getting involved with the White Sox. So I'm sure they've locked in. He's going to put some capital in now to pay some debt down, do some other things. So that's part of their deal. And I would imagine that that the big part of that is that they're locked in on what the pricing is. It's just a matter of timing. And it basically said, Reinsdorf has the has control of the team until he either dies or he's unable to run it. And if he makes it to the end of whatever their 9 or 10 year deal is, then fine. That's where it'll be. But they've ironed out ownership, but they haven't ironed out where they're going to
live. Ishby is the guy's name.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
It's a weird option thing where at one point they get an option to sell, and then the other guy gets the option to buy it for another 5 years or something. It has to do with the controlling interest.
Start accumulating other limited partner shares in the meantime.
Well, it has to do with the controlling interest, and I've never been happy when I started the business. Kevin, there was no such thing as two sets of shares where one gets the vote and the other. If you were listed on the New York Stock Exchange, they had to be voting shares. Of course, like everything, it seems, any good idea seems to change, right? And now you have places like Google and Baidu, but in their lust for the next buck, then they have separation where people like Bezos and those guys and some of these places, they control the voting shares, and the rest of the schmucks just get the other shares. Well, that didn't used to be legal. That wasn't what a common share was about. But now all of a sudden these guys are such egotistic that they the thought of them being voted out, they were, you know, can't cross their mind, right? So you wonder what the board is even doing there, because how the hell are they going to ride herd on these guys, because they're not going to. You know, those kinds of things. I mean, it's just a lot of little degradation seems to have happened in our lifetime, Kevin, when we were supposed to be the generation that fixed everything, right? I'm not so sure we did so much of that, but...
Oh, I'm really sure we did not.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody last night who was a real, he's a environmental sort of dude, and was talking about, he's been on the show, good guy, talking about how we, he actually, of course, he's... You ever meet one of these guys, Kevin, and whenever they do a trade, it's the world's best trade that anybody's ever done, and have to tell you about it? You know, I do so many trades a day, some are good, some are bad, I was trying to have a lot more of them good, right? I mean, it's... You're talking about a market. But anyway, everybody's met somebody like that. And he's telling me about this uranium company. And by the way, we did, actually, for full disclosure, I did put a little spread on in one of these uranium companies for some of my clients. Just very small, because it looks like uranium has been going up. I don't know if it's going to keep going up, but I'm talking about a very small position. Because it seems like, you know, the platinum's up, gold's up, silver's up. I'm just kind of, for lack of a better term, piling on a little bit. But the, you know, he's got some stock, and he started telling me all stuff about uranium is the future, because nuclear is the future, and we've talked about that how many years on the show, Kevin, about how the nuclear program with some of these smaller nuclear things, especially the ones that Carl talks about, the ones that have salt in them and so forth, and are much safer than the old ones. They can be a lot smaller, a lot less radioactive stuff. The fact is, we're building none of them right now. There's not one. I guess if you count the couple someone that blew up, that one and the one over in Michigan where they're bringing them back that had been shuttered, I guess you could count that as progress. Other than that, the last one was being under construction. I think went online like a year ago. So there's none under construction. So of course, we're having a conversation. I go, I'm with you. We've been talking about that for 15 years, but it ain't happening. It just isn't happening. What do you mean? It's the future. I guess it is, but it's not going to happen by breakfast. I mean, well, we've got to get rid of this coal. Coal's dirty. I said, we're exporting a boatload of coal to China, and they're burning it there, and India's building coal plants. They're building 25 coal plants or something next year, last time I looked. No nuclear plants. I mean, I'm agreeing with you. This might be the future, but we're not even. We're like the salmon that's trying to turn around and go back the other way. I mean, we're not even close here, are we?
Don't think so.
I mean, and what about the breeder reactor where we could get rid of all this spent fuel and turn it into new fuel? That's nobody. That was an idea in high school, for God's sake, Kevin. Everybody thought that by this time there wouldn't be any spent uranium rods; it'd all be recycled. That doesn't happen. I mean, nothing's happened that was supposed to happen. Just seems not nothing.
That might be the new theme for the show.
Yeah, well, nothing's happened that's supposed to happen. anyway, hey, what'd you think of this huge spat between Musk and Trump? That's kind of it's kind of out in the open, eh?
Yeah, don't care.
Really? I know it's
not really interested.
I do have a great quote here from Trump. I don't know. And whatever, it's amazing what people think of themselves and versus what other people think of them, maybe. But I'll find it here in a second. But I didn't make it to the end of that game last night. It was quite a game, eh?
I did not make it to the end. I saw how it ended, though. It was pretty impressive. That last basket with 0.3 left to go, that was the only time that the Pacers led.
Really? That happened.
We're filling the blanks for listeners. Yeah. Is the Pacers won Game One of the NBA Finals against Oklahoma City with a buzzer beater, they just kind of refused to go away. There were times when it looked like the Thunder was going to run away from them, but they just kept staying in the game.
There actually was a quote in here. It was actually by Trump. It was hilarious because if you want to, you talk about, had to do something about it. He goes, I don't understand how these people come here, they see this stuff, and then one day they're not involved as much, they wake up, and all of a sudden they see things differently or something along those lines. I'm like, Donald, look in the mirror. The guy who's the constant and all this stuff is you. People come in there, they do stuff they think they're in, or they're doing stuff you want, and they leave and they don't like you anymore. It seems like the one person who's in charge, who's the constant there is him, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. I think you're seeing Corinne Jean-Pierre doing the same thing, though. She's gone now, and now everybody sucks, and she's not a Democrat anymore.
Well, I did two people,
and there's all. And of course, there's a lot of people trying to discredit her, and apparently there was a lot of backbiting going on while she was there, so that's what's going on with that. That's all fine, but I think that's pretty typical.
Well, I mean, a couple of dudes here, Mark Cuban being one of them, has said that what we really need another party. For the 80% of the people that don't like either one of these parties right now. And I'm all for that, boy. I mean, I'm not, as you know, I'm a lifelong Democrat. I don't know where these guys are going. That's not my party. It hasn't been for 20 years. And Republicans, this group sure isn't. So where am I? I mean, I think every moderate Democrat and every moderate Republican feels they don't have a home. Now, does that mean we could ever have a third party? Spend 2 hours some Saturday morning like I did in a snowstorm. Going through what it takes to get on the ballot in every state, boy, oh boy, that we're designed here. We've designed to have one more party than Russia. We're not designed to be any kind of a democracy whatsoever because you can't get on any of these ballots. I mean, a couple times a third party's managed to get on all the ballots, right? I don't think it's even been a couple times. I don't think Ross Perot did, and I think maybe the Libertarian did. Two elections ago, and I don't think they did last time. It's real hard. I mean, I don't know what a third party would work.
It's hard because the status quo parties fight you tooth and nail on it too.
Plus, they don't need signatures or anything like that. They just get on. But if you want on, but all states are kind of different. Matter of fact, your state, Kevin, is I think one of the easiest. Because if you look at, I mean, nobody does this. All you care about is the person who won. If you actually look at the election results, some states there's you'll get Democrat, Republican, and maybe Libertarian, or maybe a Green Party or something. That's it. Other states, there's all kinds of people. Well, I saw all kinds. There could be Kevin O'Neill on there with friends and family with like 25 votes, and you're counted. So some states, it's a hell of a lot easier. I mean, I couldn't go down the list and say which is which, but. I mean, some of them, you basically only get the top three people. Some states, you have to register, and I don't know if you need signatures, to be a write-in candidate. I mean, what's that all about?
It's not clear on the concept of what write-in means.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a crazy thing. But two kind of things here regarding the stadium stuff here. If I go to a game, I wouldn't mind going to a nice place. But I also know that this whole thing with the Bears, I mean, just because you're a fan, it's short for fanatic, it's not short for imbecile, right? I mean, the last two places that have built a major football stadium are both way bigger markets in Chicago, and oh, by the way, have two teams in them. What makes anybody think here that the Bears, coming off leaving everybody with a huge chunk of debt over at Soldier Field, and paying minimal rent, what makes you think the Bears are going to be able to pull one off on their own? I mean, just so we don't go through any of the numbers, why would anybody even think that, Kevin?
Well, I don't. I think the reason that Arlington Heights has always made sense is because there's a big property and they can do other stuff around that property. They can create an entertainment district similar to what they have in Glendale, as an example, where it's busy all the time, and that that allows the property to make money, even when the football team's not playing there. And then you can do your, you know, you can do your concerts and all that kind of stuff too, which is fine. So, you know, so that's it. But, you know, that's why the lakefront has not made any sense at any point in time, because they just can't monetize the surrounding property any better.
If you look at, you don't have to go too far, because I actually have a stack of a whole booklet here of over the last 25 years of stadiums going up, Salt Lake City and other places. Gary, they've been a fiasco. Look at the Bridgeview Soccer Stadium, where the fire was. They paid a rent. It didn't cover the place. The first 10 years they were there, they had to hit up the citizens of Bridgeview for $11 million in property taxes. And all the ancillary stuff, bars, restaurants, entertainment, around the place, none of it happened. None of it happened. Now, the Sox Park, sort of the same way. Sox Park didn't want anybody buying a beer outside the park. They'd actually put up a bar there in the parking lot that you could go before the game that they owned. Actually, the Pier and Exposition Authority, whoever it is, owned, or the Stadium Authority. They didn't want anybody outside the place. So there's this whole idea that the park becomes a competitor to the people around the place. Is anybody not is unfamiliar on this concept? The only time you can pull something like that off is if you are in a neighborhood that already is there, like Wrigleyville or Pittsburgh. All of a sudden, all the places across the street, there's all kinds of really neat places to go and so forth. But I don't know that anybody goes there when the Pirates aren't playing. I mean, this whole idea, oh, don't worry, we'll make it up on the concerts. Okay, okay. I had this argument with my nephew of all people. I go, okay, tell me how many concerts, tell me how many people are showing up, tell me the competition of other open-air arenas around the place, or I guess if it's a dome, it's not open-air, but tell me how much you can actually make on a concert. Tell me how many you can make on a demolition derby. I mean, go through the numbers for me. Are we really talking about $50 million towards the debt thing? I mean, what are we talking here? I mean, the number, if you're talking about a $5 billion stadium, which the soccer stadium isn't, we're talking at any sort of normal interest rate, say five, well, say six, it's $300 million a year in interest, just in interest. Kevin, that's a lot of concerts. I mean, does anybody have a calculator? And
that's why you have to have that whole, if you're going to make it work, you have to have that whole district that is, you know, it's all set up, it's got all kinds of restaurants, entertainment. Have you ever been to the Glen in Glenview?
No. Glenview or Glendale?
Glenview. It's the space where there used to be, where the base used to be.
Okay. Well, I've driven by there. The golf course is still there, and they've built a bunch of houses too, right?
They still have golf course. They still have, condominiums, townhouses, all that kind of stuff. And then they have a central district that is just, you know, it's kind of a destination. Go spend the day, the evening. There's lots of places to get drinks, to get food.
But downtown, essentially.
Okay. It is a new downtown for Glenview. And that's how they built out the area in Glendale around the football stadium.
Well, who plays there?
Glendale, the Arizona Cardinals.
Okay, well, I was all on board, Kevin, when the White Sox Stadium was built. I mean, it's so old we are. I was all on board then. This area in the South Loop, I mean, if somebody would have asked me, I would have said, that's exactly where that stadium should go. Because Old Comiskey was...
That could work, yeah.
Okay, no, but what are the reasons, my reasons why it would work would make it an absolute non-starter for Jerry Reinsdorf or anybody like him. Because Jerry wanted, in my world, you would build it just the other side of Roosevelt Road. You would have a high capacity, you know, I'm talking like a streetcar or something like that, because I know trains. I would have streetcars, and I would go back and forth from downtown, so nobody had to move their car. You could leave your car in your downtown parking garage, hop on this thing, and be there in, you know, a minute and a half, and after the game, come right back. You wouldn't have to move your car. Now, none of these people want one of these places if they don't get the parking. That's where a lot of the revenue is. They would not want my plan whatsoever because of a lot of reasons people haven't thought of. Yes, should a good place like that be there where people could... And by the way, why not start the games at 6 o'clock?
Well, but you want it to be a destination even when there are no games.
Well, with what I'm saying, the downtown area is. Imagine what would have happened in the South Loop between where we are and Roosevelt Road. That whole area would. You're right, but there's already people living there. All of a sudden, you'd have 15 restaurants and bars. It would. I think it would have worked spectacularly. But now, the park doesn't want that. They want the Stadium Club. They want you coming there for dinner. They don't want people outside the place. When the White Sox Park went up, they swore on a stack of Bibles that all the bars across the street, the East Beard, Old Comiskey, would all get a space and they'd all be back. Not one of them is back. Not one. So
yeah, and yet if you go up north, you know where the Cubs are.
Well, that's different though.
They own a hell of a lot of it too. But well, yeah. That really has become an entertainment district.
But it kind of always was. There's people living there. I mean, it's.
There was stuff to do. Theaters were there, and you know, it kind of always was, but it's more so now.
What I'm saying the little bit of that Comiskey Park had, they purposely got rid of, and won't let it. You can't build a bar across the street. You were supposed to be able to. All of a sudden, I don't want to do that. Okay. So you can't purposely keep the neighborhood out and then bitch because you don't have the neighborhood, right?
I agree.
I mean,
now when I go back to Arlington Heights, I say that is doable for the Bears if they, you know, if they want to do that. There's a lot of investment dollars that have to go in there. They have to figure out what, you know, how much that's going to be theirs and how much isn't. But that's, you know, that can make the property work. If they just want to build a standalone stadium out in, you know, in the old Arlington Park space, it's not going to be economically sound.
You know what it absolutely reminds me of? Pontiac. It's about the same distance. It's probably 35, 40 miles outside of Detroit. Actually, Arlington Heights is probably a little further. You can't get there from here. So what do you think would happen if the Bears were playing there this year with the Kennedy under construction? What's the time frame to get back and forth if you live anywhere in the city and an expressway under construction, and oh, by the way, everybody's drinking and coming home and driving back? Does that make any sense whatsoever to anybody?
No, but nothing about the Kennedy project makes any sense.
Well, but I'm saying you're talking about 60,000 people driving 50 miles on roads that are already crowded. I mean, how many people are going to go on a train? A lot of smart people are going to go on the train.
Yeah, the same Kennedy problem now, because anybody coming in from the northwest suburbs has to get downtown. That's a problem, too.
Well, if it's me, and if, you know, if the mayor had any, well, he's got a lot of chutzpah in a lot of areas, I would say, guess what? You move to Arlington Park, you're no longer the Chicago Bears. You can be the Illinois Bears, you can be whatever you want to be, you can be. And by the way, I'm going to offer the Soldier Field lease to a couple teams that are dying in the NFL. I bet the Jacksonville Jaguars are here. Blue smoke's going to come out their ass to get here, Kevin. Unless they go to London instead. But they, I mean, why do we have any affinity for these people? What have they ever done for the city? I mean, what do you think the rent they paid at Wrigley Field all those years? The thought of that family writing a $5 billion check, for God's sake. But anyway, real quick, I'll keep this very brief, Kevin. I sent you that picture. When Kevin mentioned earlier infrastructure in this area, it's not just, you know, a little something-something. That whole area, South Loop, is one of the most amazing, urban projects I've ever come across, Kevin, because if you look at a map of Chicago, south of the Loop, the Chicago River runs south. Well, it used to have a big bend that ran over to damn near where the rail tracks were. So they decided, okay, if we can straighten the river out here, not only do you not have barges having to go around this bend, it's way better for navigation, it's way better, we can extend the railroad tracks, and oh, by the way, we can run two streets down here and make like a big neighborhood where there's nothing here now. So they spent, this is 1929, so they spent all this money, dig this huge trench, straighten out the river. It's why if you go by that area, you'll see the side of the river is all that reinforced iron stuff. Mm-hmm. You say, well, wow, it looks artificial, only because it is. So it's essentially a canal in that area, and then they filled in the other part of the river. And now we were talking about the Depression, hitting the 30s. The last thing the city needed was another big, huge neighborhood and start putting in streets and stuff. So no street ever went in there. It's a massive vacant lot basically in the middle of a city. One street was put in a few years ago, but it's closed. There's nowhere to go on the thing. But there's no electric, there's no sewer, there's no water, there's no gas, there's no nothing in that whole area. So when you talk about infrastructure, you're talking millions of dollars just to get all that stuff in there. And that's one of the probably the single biggest reason why nothing has gone up there. Plus, it's always been owned by some sleazebag. It was owned by Tony Resco for a while. And then I don't know who owns it now, but it's probably the single biggest piece of property in a city that has been owned by somebody for pushing now 90 years that has never been developed. And whoever owned it just pays interest on it and finally finds some other chump to buy it from, thinking there's something's going to go in there, and nothing ever goes in there, Kevin. It is one of the most amazing urban stories, I think, countrywide. In the middle of a city this size, you can have... I mean, it's... Well, it goes from Roosevelt Road to, I'm going to say, at least 20th, maybe 19th Street, so that's 7/8 of a mile. And from east to west, it's got to be three, four blocks. So let's say almost a mile by a half a mile, maybe not quite that big. So we're talking, what is that? You know, it's a half a square mile. It's at least a half a square mile. I mean, it's a massive piece of property, and it's got railroad tracks on one side, and it's got the river on the other side. So you can imagine water taxis. You can imagine all kinds of stuff. But it's never happened because everybody looks at the price and they go, ugh. So yeah, if the guy ponies up for the $650 million for the place, the soccer stadium, I'm going to guess the city has to pony up, or the gas company, or whoever the hell wants to get in there, at least half of that, Kevin, at least half, maybe more, to make that. That's where the Bears stadium was going to go, that's where the Sox stadium was going to go, and everybody looks at it and they go, nope. Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah, and that is, and that's, you know, that's exactly what I said at the beginning is, okay, we understand it's going to be built with private money except for the part that's not.
Yeah. Well, everybody will crow off an open window about how the United Center is built on private money. But to move across the street, I think the city had to move a big pumping station or something under one of the streets that was multi-million dollar. It's not free for everybody else. It never is it?
No. It definitely is not. Heck, you know, just from an infrastructure standpoint, I saw every time I went to a basketball game, I saw what they had to do just to put up a hockey arena on the other side of the parking lot, and just how much went into pulling power and water and fiber and, I mean, you name it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That all had to get across, and really ruined basketball parking for a year.
Well, but to a certain extent, though, that's what people pay taxes for. I mean, if somebody is going to use their money to build a really nice community where people are living and doing stuff and paying taxes, it's their right to have an expressway exit near them, isn't it? Isn't that why they pay taxes? I mean, it's not, when we say it's costing money, infrastructure is what people pay for every time you send your bill in. Right, your tax bill. So it's not like it, you know, should, if somebody's going to build a United Center, should the city pony up for a L stop at the place? Well, yeah, don't you think? That's why you have L's, so people can go from place to place they want to go, right? So it's not like, you know, that's a cost to you and me. It should be they should be paid for by more riders, shouldn't it? I mean, that's an investment that people make everywhere. I mean, if you get off the L in your neighborhood, somebody made an investment in that place, right? Somebody's paid for it forever.
Yeah, so it would be deluxe if they just understood the investment they're making and don't grossly overestimate the benefits.
Oh, that's what you do. that's what you do in politics, and that's what you do, you know, all across the way. I mean, what do you think the upshot's going to be on this bill with Musk, saying he's going to. Well, yesterday he was going to, anybody who votes for the bill, he's going to support their opponent in the next election. I mean, I think a lot of the Republicans are running, their elections are, what, 18 months from now? This can't be nice if you're running.
He isn't wrong about that, and I'm sure, especially because he donated some of his time to start trying to uncover some of the BS that's going on, and then the bill doesn't address it, I can understand his disappointment. could also understand his disappointment that they're lifting the EV mandate.
So people understand what we're talking about here, there's all kinds of layers of things, depending on your state, that entice you to get an electric vehicle. Now, we've had Carl and other people on the show say, if you really go from soup to nuts, and you talk about the minerals and so forth, and that has to go into the battery and the car and the disposal, and what do you do with all these batteries 10 years from now, and by the way, where is the power actually generated, how far is it coming over the lines? You could make, in a lot of areas of the country, a really strong argument that you're way better off with just a regular old gas car. I mean, it's local. If you're living next door, if you're on a farm and you got your own solar collector, I guess it's okay for you. I mean, if they're piping your electricity from a natural gas plant 20 miles away, I'm thinking you're better off in a car your own. But anyway, it's not all that given here. But what they're talking about is if you buy a Tesla, I don't know if it's price weighted, Kevin, because I never looked. You get a 7,500 hour tax credit, right? That's the EV credit they're talking about.
That's part of it, but the other part.
Well, not to mention that last year Tesla got $2.3 billion in carbon credits from other places. It was a record year on it. Now, that's just revenue, a check. So every time you buy a Chevy pickup or a Ford pick-me-up, part of your purchase price is essentially going to a carbon credit that Ford has to buy, and they're buying them from Tesla. Now, that's why, even though they really don't...
And Ford's benefiting from it, too, on its EV fleet.
Well, so they're able to pay one division into the other, but I still think they're not even, Kevin. But
probably not.
But it can't be that even, because these guys got their biggest check ever last year, right? So they got that part going. Plus, as a Tesla owner, depending on your state, and I think Indiana's a little smarter on this, in Illinois you don't pay any road use taxes, even though the damn car's heavier than my pickup truck. I mean, I pay if I buy 1,000 gallons of gas a year, I'm paying $930 in taxes. But those taxes are allegedly going for potholes, for new roads, for maintenance, for new bridges, all that kind of crap. So the Tesla people don't get paid any of that. So they essentially have three dodges here, right, that they're getting. And I think this bill is removing the 7,500. I don't think it's doing anything about the carbon credit.
It's also a mandate that you're going to be forced into buying EVs over a period of time.
Right, but did you just read this morning? I know what your next truck is going to be.
I know it'll be too. It'll be my first.
That's right, because now the Chrysler, or whoever they are, Stellantis or whatever they call them, has brought back the Hemi. But on the side of the truck, it's not going to say Hemi. As far as you don't know, it's a particular design of a V8 engine. It's 5.7 liter, which means 350 cubic inches. And the side of the thing is going to be some design showing something coming out of something else, which essentially means that you're freedom. You get to buy what you want. You don't have to buy what people tell you. So you can go back to buying the V8 engine you've always loved. We're giving people a choice. We're not going to make them buy an electric pickup, which we think is probably dog poop in the first place. So now you go back and get your...
I'm not buying them, so yeah, we're not going to make you not buy them.
Yeah. So now you can go out and buy, by the end of summer, Kevin, you can go out and order yourself a Hemi, maybe, and go down the street nice and fast. You're good to go. So there.
Cool.
What did you think about the thing with Lou yesterday? I'm amazingly fascinated by this Ukraine attack. Turns out they knocked out. Two or three of the, what do you call the planes with the big huge saucer on top to tell all the other planes where to go?
AWACS.
AWACS. They destroyed two or three AWACSs. Those things. I bet Russia doesn't have many of those, do you? I mean, I don't think we have many of those. I mean, one's supposed to be good for a whole theater.
Yeah, probably not. So, yeah, they did a lot of damage. You know, my concern about all of it, and I'm not blaming Ukraine for this, for brinksmanship or escalation. But what I am saying is every time one of these gets a, you know, a big hit, especially if it's a big hit against Russia, I think that, you know, that increases the possibility that we'll see nuclear weapons used. And so you know, while on the one hand, good for Ukraine, they landed a big roundhouse.
Plus, they didn't kill anybody, did they?
On the other hand, it makes me nervous.
Well, me too, but they didn't kill anybody, did they?
I don't know, I believe they didn't, but, you know, I don't know if there was a death toll or not.
I was stunned at how small these things can be. I just assumed, you know, when I heard about this drone attack, I'm driving the car, right? So, of course, you know, you can't read anything. I you know, would never assume you make an ass out of me and an ass out of you. I assume when you see the drones, I mean, I was mentioning this yesterday, you see the little guys that people can play. You can go buy one, right? And you can buzz the thing around the neighborhood. Maybe it's got a camera on it, maybe it doesn't. Then there's something a little bigger and a lot better that Audrey has guys. She hires guys. If you want to list a big house, Audrey does a terrific job on this. A shameless plug. Matter of fact, she's listed a big house in Burr Ridge. She doesn't usually do stuff in Burr Ridge, but she's got one. The thing's, you know, $1.5 million, Kevin. It's like, I don't know, a couple acres or something. The thing is gorgeous. Well, you're not going to go out there with, you know, me, you know, somebody with their cell phone. So she has a guy come over with a drone. He's taking a picture of the whole property and this view, that view. Those are a little bigger and way more sophisticated. It costs a lot more because then they can take pictures and you can aim the camera and all that stuff. But I never dreamed that something of that style. And then you see the ones that you know, the Navy flies. It's damn near a pilot, you know, it's like a pilotless plane. I just assumed to have any kind of ordnance, you know, a bomb in it essentially, that it had to be one of those other kind. And then you could, you know, could attack a Russian base, you know, 50 miles from where, from Ukraine. And I start hearing about 2,300 miles away. How the hell did they do that? Well, Blue says those, the ones that, you know, Audrey's guy uses, if it's not that much bigger, you can put this high explosive on the stuff. It's maybe less than 10 pounds of ordnance. And if you can land it in the right spot, it'll wreck a plane. And that's essentially what they did. The thing flies into the plane, evidently, right? It's like a kamikaze drone. It flies right into the spot of the plane. And he goes, yeah, you can put this thing on your desk. I had no idea that was the case. Thank God, Lou. We get Lou. I mean, did you? I mean, I just assumed in order to do damage to something, it had to be way bigger than that, but evidently not.
No, I'm not surprised.
Well, yeah, you're more into this stuff. I just never thought that the thing, you know, Audrey's guy uses at the same size could carry even 10 pounds. Looks like the camera weighs about, you know, 8 ounces on the thing.
Have you seen any of the videos of delivery drones and where that's going for consumer products?
I'll say not as much as I should have, it appears, eh? Well, how big are those?
Same, you know, they're small, you know, but they can carry a package that is of substantial weight.
How many blades, and how wide are the blades?
Usually 4, and they're not very wide.
Really? Well, I guess I got to go to a drone field and check one of these things out. But anyway, they had them in prefab housing, so they're just driving them along on trucks. How nobody found out about that over a year? It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, they pulled off an incredible attack and an incredible hit on them. Again, you know, I just don't like us. I don't like watching things, you know, the ante get increased in time after time.
Well, you know, I've
not blaming the Ukrainians. They're in a war. They should do, you know, if you're going to be if you're in a war, it's all about winning and losing. It's all about, you know, nailing the crap out of the other guy. It's not a political event for them. So that's not my complaint. My complaint is just the in general. I hate to see this escalate in any way because I think the consequences of escalation can be horrible.
Well, I do too. I would certainly not have approved that anyone wants to ask you or me if they would have used the drones to like take out a hospital in Moscow. I mean, I think I probably would have thought. But you know, it is funny, Kevin. I got some of the stuff you read that stays with you and informs opinions and things like this. Is, you know, Putin is an egotistical dude. I mean, I don't think anybody will disagree with that. And these people think, they not only think they get to win, they think they get to make the rules. You know, and one of the first instances I ever heard about that in wartime, everybody you know, everybody our age, because our parents and so forth were involved, I think, has read something regarding World War II and Roosevelt and the Depression and things like that. And I'll be perfectly honest, I don't know near as much about the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, and World War I than I should. Okay, now it's a hell of a long time ago, but again, if you want to know something about American history, you know, I read that thing to everybody about a year ago regarding the money supply numbers, Confederate and Union during the war, and how the Union managed to keep their money growth and their inflation down, and that was one of the big things that participated in the, you know, industry growing up here in the South. Not only had widespread inflation, their currency was easily counterfeited, and the place fell apart, which had as much to do with them losing probably as more people getting killed. Anyway, the mantra on the seas has always been that you had, you know, battleships of God knows when, going back to the wooden ones, and you blasted people, and when you won, you picked up survivors, right? And so the Germans invented this new thing called a submarine. I don't know if they were the first that invented it, but they... Actually, I think there was a small submarine war in the Civil War, but... So they go out and they blast this British ship. Now, of course, the submarine has no ability to pick up survivors, so there are survivors in the water, and the other British ship turns around to pick up the survivors, and they blast that ship. Which, of course, now they can't pick up any survivors, and off they go. And now, immediately, Britain appeals to the Geneva Convention, saying, this is bull. You can't do this because you can't blast some ship if you can't pick up survivors. And first of all, at that point, in the middle of the war, I don't know what the Geneva Convention could have said, but I'm sitting there going, really? I mean, because, you know, their view was you're supposed to line up a bunch of battleships, the other guys lined up theirs, and you slammed away, which just so happened the Brits had, like, twice as many battleships as the Germans, so they would love to have that rule in force. But it didn't work out that way, right? I mean, my view of, you know, I know we have people on the show that, you know, cut Putin a lot more slack than I do about, you know, whether Ukraine should have been able to join NATO and all that crap. I mean, I agree with a lot of that, and what was a deal wasn't a deal. But then I see a picture of, you know, Angelica's hospital where she was born and school where she went, and the thing is rubble on the ground, and I'm going, I don't care what, the deal didn't work out so right. I don't know anybody that gets a right to do that. So that's kind of where I come from on this. But you're right. I don't want to see Ukraine, you know, do something in Russia to where this guy drops a nuke. But I also get the idea, how does Putin make the declaration that the only place we're going to do war is in your place and not ours? How does that work? I mean, it's two ends of the magnet, right?
Well, it's kind of the ideal way to do it, isn't it?
Well, I think that at some point, Ukraine...
And it's the difference between being on defense and being on offense. And yeah. For a hot minute there, Ukraine was on offense.
I mean, I think somewhere along the line, if I'm not the strategist, it'd be more of a Mike question, but if, and Lou mentioned it yesterday, if they want to do something, they're going to have to go around that Russian front, probably into Belarus, around them, and get behind them. I mean, that's what we did in Korea. That's what we did in World War I, right? We went around, and that's what the Germans did in World War II. They went around the line. I mean, otherwise, you're just slugging and losing people day to day, aren't you? So where are you in the class situation? We only got a few minutes here.
Class will start next week.
This is the summer term equal in terms of length and credits, or is it different?
Well, it's like we do 8-week classes anyway. So even in the fall, when you have a 16-week term, you will take 18-week classes, then you will do a break, and then you'll do 8-week classes again. So the summer is just one group of 8-week classes.
So if you want to go take a full year of accounting where you go through the whole book, you got to take what, like 6 in a row? Accounting 1, accounting 2, accounting 3?
So you can get in, say, you can take accounting 1, accounting 2 in the fall term. You can take a couple of additional courses in the spring, but yeah, you can work summer into there.
What do you do for a curriculum?
I suggest that people, when they have to take their accounting courses, because like if you're a supply chain person and you're, you know, accounting's not your thing, I suggest to them that they take their accounting requirement in the summer.
What do you have for people in Illinois? I'm asking because our buddy Andrew, I think, is he's got his degree in Columbia in graphic art and those kinds of things, and I think he's looking to expand a hair, maybe because of my saying you better expand a hair. But do you guys, what happens if somebody from Illinois wants to go there? Is it possible, or should they find a place here?
Yeah, there's an out-of-state tuition, so it's a little bit higher, but yeah. And depending on what he wants to study, if he wants to do like website development and so on, he can do that. I have people offering the course via Zoom this summer, so that there are options there. And and by the same token, you can look at some of the visual communication stuff as business, and you might want to round it out with some business degree. But I don't recommend a business associates for anybody. I'd say get the associates, but plan on not stopping. That you should, if you're going to study business, then you're going to need a bachelor's degree for anybody to pay any attention to.
Well, for somebody who already has a degree, I've been trying to, I wish you were riding in with this because you know more than I do. I think you need to round out something, you know, some basic finance course, some at least, because he says he doesn't know what we're talking about. Maybe some basic finance course, some basic management course, something maybe in design, something just to round stuff out, something that maybe you and I would have taken a few classes in, even if that wasn't our major. I mean, we knew a lot of guys that were in governments that still took a year of accounting or something at Notre Dame. I mean, it wasn't like they totally walked by the business school or the economics school. Plus, I think a lot of the guys in business took courses other places, right? I always did. I mean, I was in economics at Notre Dame.
So is taking courses in ones and twos a possibility? Sure it is.
I mean, it doesn't... I'm all for... I don't really care if you get a degree. He's already got a degree. I don't care what your degree is. I want, when somebody walks in the room and starts talking about something, I want you to know what the hell the guy's talking about. It's more of an intimidation thing than anything else, right? You like to at least understand what people are saying. That was always...
Well, so that's and exactly, which is why I do an accounting hit in just about every class I teach anyway. I say, okay, we're going to take an hour, and I'm going to walk through some really basic accounting concepts for you.
Do you have a little workbook for them?
Pardon?
Do you have a little workbook for them?
No.
See, if you don't actually have your pencil and put the...
I walk them through the whole process of... How do you get to a net income? How do you get to what's a cash flow? What's an EBITDA? These are things that, whether if you're an IT person or you're a supply chain person, if you ever expect to spend money and you've got to put together proposals, you've got to be able to speak to your CFO.
So you don't ever make somebody actually write down, somebody sends you a check for $100. I'm debiting cash for $100 and I'm crediting income.
I walk through all of that. I just don't make them do the exercise. It's not part of the course material.
So. Okay. Because everybody had their workbook and type of thing. So what's your call on Cubs Detroit?
This will be interesting. Detroit, however, I'm wondering how seriously I should take them after they lost two games this week to the White Sox.
That's true. Well, I thought...
They get Scooble tonight. That'll be interesting.
Well, the Cubs were... by the way, I was thinking about you the other night, and not so much in a good way.
I love to be on your mind, Tom.
They decided to put Pete Crow in the cleanup spot, right, in the second game. So the first inning, they got bags loaded, nobody out, if you're watching it. So Pete Crow comes up, and I go, I hope that knucklehead Kevin isn't right. Should have... three swings of balls out of the strike zone. He's out. The next guy strikes out, and the next guy pops out, and I'm going, that's the night they got shut out. They had three people on base and nobody out in the first.
They got shut out. What was really discouraging about that as well is it was discouraging to get nothing out of bases loaded and nobody out, but it was also discouraging. I've seen this like three times in the last week. I'm wondering about Ian Happ as a base runner. Because three times he's been on second base, there's been a single, and he's wound up stopped at third. And when they show the pan out view of everything going on the bases, he's just frozen on the liner. It's like he hasn't checked where the outfields are, because these are not really close. And you know, I'm paying attention now to see if this is a real type of trend.
What Kevin's talking about is at second base, if you know there's a big hole in right center, and you see the ball heading to right center, you take off because you figure nobody's there, nobody's going to get it, right?
Well, and you know where your infielders are. Are your infielders deep, or are they shallow? Are they in? Are they playing double play depth and so on? So you don't need a lot of read, and so base running is all about getting secondary leads and getting a good jump, a good read on the ball, and a good jump. And you have to know all of that. And in each case, Hap did not, and wound up not scoring as a result of it. Now a couple of the other times he might have scored anyway. I don't remember, but I remember because I have a tendency to just sit there and say, you know, I don't like bad baseball of any kind. And so when it happens once, they go, why aren't you going? Where, you know, what's going on there? You should not be coasting into third on that base hit.
Yeah, pulling who was the guy in the sacks? First baseman, Paul Konerko.
Yeah.
I was at Sox Park one night, and the guy whacks the hell out of this ball. The guy had nothing but power. It goes out, and it hits the left field wall and bounces back off. And I see him jogging to first place, takes a little turn. Dude, you just hit the wall. At least if you got a really good left fielder, at least act like you're thinking about second base.
make him throw the ball.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. At least it'll make it sound.
Interesting case, yeah. Because he was you know, well built, lean, you know, kind of tall and lean, and a really, really good ball player. But he may be the slowest in shape, you know, athletically built guy I've ever seen. He just was remarkably slow runner. So, you know, I guess a man's got to know his limitations.
Well, we got to go to Carl, but there was a guy in the OEX pit, and I tell you what, that's why it was so much fun trading. This guy, he was taller than me, 6'5 or so. He's older. He still played some basketball, and guy's named Bill something. He's funnier than hell. Comes down the aisle, and Ronnie goes, well, how's your basketball game, Bill? And he goes, Ryan, let me tell you, I'm deceptively slow. Ronnie goes, what the hell does that mean? He goes, I look slow, but I'm really a lot slower. Ronnie's looking at him like, what are you, from Mars? But he goes, I'm not kidding. There you go. So anyway, have a good weekend. I assume Carl's with us. It's our big day about the jobs numbers, and after the ADP numbers and everything this week, and some of the stuff with productivity and so forth, Carl's got a lot to say before the numbers come out. So you want to take about a 10-second break here, Ricky, and then we'll come back.
Carl's got a lot to say. I find that hard to believe.
Yeah, really. It is a shock. But we don't need to go to break. SP Futures up 25.
You guys do a great job.
SP Futures up 25. NASDAQ Futures up 92. So we're pushing north here. We talked earlier in the week about maybe that's money supply driven, but we don't know. Carl, what's up, buddy? How are you?
Well, you know. Yeah, you're right. I do have a lot to say with the numbers that already have come out. And then, of course, in about half an hour, well, now, 24 minutes, we're going to get, you know, the big one, right?
The big one.
The big one. Well,
the gong show? When the Coneheads went on the what was the show?
Yeah, you know, what
the big one?
Yeah, exactly. Well, what I think is interesting about the data that has shown up recently, I mean, the productivity and unit labor cost figures that were out a couple of days ago, nobody really paid any attention to that. You know, I saw basically zero reporting on it. I mean, I scanned through CNBC's top level page and stuff like that looking for it. I listened to some of their stuff right after it came out a little bit, and nobody really paid a lot. I mean, you know, of course, they announced what it was, right? But then that was it. Then they pretty much went radio silent on it. And I found it a fascinating report, because it's so far out of character with what we've seen over the last few years. Okay.
How about starting? We got time. How about starting from the beginning here? Because the way efficiency used to be done. It came off the rails at some point. Now maybe you're going to tell me. Hopefully you'll tell me it's back on the rails. It was a real simple calculation. How many labor hours do you have? How many Levi's did you produce?
Right.
And you divide one into the other. But then it got all screwed up where if all of a sudden you're making your Levi's somewhere else and not here, you almost made it to infinite productivity, but in fact you weren't doing anything. I don't know how they've adjusted all these calculations to make up for all this kind of different stuff that's going on in the last 30 years.
Well, they sort of didn't, because it's productivity and unit labor costs inside the United States.
Okay.
So you have a sweatshop in Vietnam with 200 women, buttholes to elbows, no fire suppression. It's cheaper, right? That stuff doesn't go into the figures because it's not here and they can't measure it. So that's one of the things. And by the way, that kind of plays into this whole thing, that we never really got to talk about, but you and I had a little back and forth in the email, which is the whole tariff thing is about first arm's length sale, because it is the act of exporting from the tariffed nation that has a final destination to the United States that is the taxable event. Okay, the taxable event is triggered by the landing of the goods in the U.S. However, just like with a value-added tax over in Europe, it is that first step of production in the place that's impacted by the tariff.
What if they're both impacted? What if they're both?
I get that, but
I'm asking a question. What if there's a 20% tax on China that goes to Vietnam, and there's another 10% of Vietnam? Does it end up being 30?
Well, it could be, because it depends on exactly how it all kind of goes to, except it's not 30 on the whole thing. It's on the value at the time of the export.
Okay.
So if I this is the common business arrangement this isn't unique to people trying to dodge, U.S. environmental and labor standards. You are a producer of a product. You sell it to middlemen, and the middlemen ultimately sell it to the end user, right? So, there's frequently there is this multi-layer thing. That's not unusual at all. In fact, it's very usual. But it is that first layer that is where the tax gets levied. So if I have, I make T-shirts in China, and there's a 30% tax, 30% tariff on that, and I sell those T-shirts to a wholesaler in Vietnam, okay, but I sell them for $1, and then the Vietnam company sells them to Earthbound for $4, and Earthbound sells them for $30 in the United States. Okay, the tariff isn't on the 30 or the 4; it's on the 1.
Right.
Okay, so that's it, and that's always been true. That's not a new thing. That's how it's always been computed, because that's where the taxable event is. It's the same kind of thing like with, you buy a stock and then you sell a stock. The taxable event is that you sold the stock.
Well, okay, now the number, if you Google or you AI is kind of wrong. So at least you guys got me in the habit of reading down 3 or 4 more articles before I quote the AI.
Right. Careful doing that.
When we talk about $3.8 trillion of imports every year here, and the administration is having a estimate that we're going to, they're going to make $600 million. I don't think they're going to. $600 billion, by the way. Is that $3.8 trillion that can't be retail price here? It has to be price coming in from the first place. Or what is it?
This gets complicated because, of course, the people in the government lie to suit whatever their particular agenda is.
But they're saying $3.8 trillion of that's whatever that number is, times 10% is $380 billion. They're assuming, or they want us to assume, that's on the price at the border that we're paying from China or someplace.
But it isn't.
Okay, that's where I'm...
But it isn't. And but the other thing is that because the tariff is not simply on one country,
right?
Okay, that if there's, you know, if the blended average is 10%, all right, across all the nations, then yeah, if you bring in $3.8 trillion worth of stuff, yeah, it might be $380 billion worth of tariffs, okay, across the year, because the blended percentage is 10%. Okay, now China gets hammered for 165, but China gets hammered 165 on a dollar on the T-shirt, right?
Well, then, right? How do you?
But see, the thing is, it's not 165 of, you know, $8, which is the landed price in the U.S., right? And that's where the misunderstanding is coming from. But so back to the labor productivity and cost thing, because I think this is really important. All right, so we got the first quarter GDP numbers, which were very soft. Okay.
Were the revision? I didn't see the revision. Were they any better?
The advance estimate is, yeah, okay. I mean, again, you have to be careful that, you know, if you're going to cherry pick, that you don't say, well, you know, the revision for the second estimate or third estimate, we're going to use that one when it's nice, and we're not going to use the first one. That's kind of BS, right? So that number was soft, but then the productivity and costs, and remember, this is first quarter, so this, you know, goes all the way from January, right, before Trump came into office. But the productivity and cost numbers were bad on the headline, all right? They showed increasing cost and decreasing productivity. Now, you would say, oh, God, that ain't good, right? Because the thing is that the government deficit, the ability to run deficits and not have them show up immediately in inflation and choke off what you're trying to do, because the bond market reacts to that, of course, is that historically speaking, the productivity improvement in the private enterprise has been a little over 2%. All right. Now, the interesting thing is that in coming out of the last set of stuff, you know, which of course was, you know, the great financial crisis, and then, you know, and then the COVID crazy stuff, this trend from the last two events has been on a downward slope. So and a lot of people have tried to glad hand the why is easy. Every time that you pump the money supply in order to do this kind of thing, what you end up doing is damaging productivity and increase unit labor costs. Well, this is bad twice.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's two negatives. That is not the right way to go. But that's what we've done. And we've done it repeatedly. So now, in the current cycle, the average is under 2%. It's been about 1.8. Historically, it's been a little over 2. 1.8 over, you know, down to 1.8. That's not a good thing. And, of course, these are all compounded figures. So over time, this gets more serious the longer it goes on. But now we have a negative number. And the interesting thing about it is that in the manufacturing sector, which, you know, is a small piece of our, you know, we're a service economy, right? The manufacturing sector actually saw improved productivity, not decreasing, which means that all the damage was on the services side, and it wasn't small.
How can that even be?
Well, I have a theory.
Right. Well, let's hear it.
Everyone has been screaming about any. All you got to do is say the word AI, and your stock goes up $50, right? Problem I have here is that when you look at, you know, you mentioned, well, you know, you Google something, you better be careful that you don't just listen to their AI summary right on the top of the page. Problem with those AI summaries is they're frequently BS. Those AIs are expensive as hell to run.
By the way, just to emphasize what you just said, manufacturing jobs now 12.7 million, manufacturing jobs 2017.2.
Right.
And if you where are you on the mark that for every manufacturing job around the place, in terms of lunch sandwich makers, breakfast places, saloons, you name it, people that support that manufacturing job, I think that number got to be, what, almost two other people for every person in a plant? And so when you're talking about 5 million down, you're really talking more like 25 or 30, right?
Yeah, it's not, you know, this is one of the things that kind of, it was a really kind of serious situation in the general circumstance, in that, you know, I thought about this, you know, way back when I was running my place, all right? So, you know, I pay somebody a salary, right, to, you know, whatever, hourly wage or salary if they're exempt, whatever have you. But that person, they take that money and they spend it. So, you know, the guy who sits on my tech support desk, it seems like a fairly mundane job, but, you know, kind of entry-level thing, helping people, you know, put the configuration information in, or you know, answering the question, well, why is my account, you know, why doesn't my account work? Well, it doesn't work because you didn't pay your, you know, to pay your bill.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. I mean, yeah. Oh, well, here's my credit card number. Okay. So, but I mean, these are mundane positions, but they have to be done in every business. All right. They are just the basics of business, conducting business. But that person goes to lunch and you know, goes across the street and buys a deli sandwich. Right?
Yeah.
And as a result, all the people that work in the deli that make the sandwich have jobs. And then they go home and they go to the grocery store and they, you know, maybe they don't want to deal with the parking, so, you know, so they buy, you know, tokens for the, you know, for the L. Well, that means that the CTA guy has a job driving the train, right? And so do all the people, you know, cleaning it and lubricating the wheels and, you know, all the stuff, right, that goes into providing all these services and infrastructure.
Of course, now the sandwich costs you more than you pay the guy per hour.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was starting to become a problem when, you know, when Sarah first started getting jobs. You know, everyone starts at the bottom, right? When they first go into this, you know, she was washing dishes at a place, and place went out from under her. It happens, right? Restaurants, they don't have much of an operating margin. Well, you know, due to no fault of her own, the place closes, right? Well, but the thing is that the tolls just to get across the bridge were a substantial part of what she made during her shift.
And nobody cares about that.
Well, nobody, but you know, yeah. What? You ought to, because she's living at home because she's still in school and stuff. So, I mean, you know, it's not like she has to make the rent off that. But if she had, that would have been a serious problem.
Well, the every time you see something, you know, it's like, I don't know, you know, making a connection here, but anytime something happens, if it doesn't happen to you,
right,
somehow or another, I mean, They keep increasing the taxes on the downtown parking, right? So Audrey has a client, which is a lot of clients, and a person wants to get out of Illinois into Indiana. At the time, you could sell a house here, buy a hell of a lot nicer house in Indiana. Now, that has narrowed quite a bit in the last 4 or 5 years. And now you have less taxes over there and blah, blah, blah. But, it, you know, whatever the savings were, the guy works in downtown Chicago. Well, he used to be able to take... I think he used to be able to take the train, which was, you know, 75 hours a month or something, maybe 100, you know. I mean, it wasn't very much. Well, now he's driving it. Well, the city, in their infinite lack of wisdom, sold the Chicago Skyway Bridge to somebody.
Yeah, I remember this.
Yeah. Well, now the toll is like $780 each way for like a two-mile Skyway. Not to mention the Indiana Toll Road, you got to pay one a mile in Indiana.
Right.
So the total tab on the is probably... I'll be nice and say $9 each way. So that's 18. It costs the guy 25 or 30 today to park. So we're talking $50 a day. That's 250. We totally burned up. What he's saving on the house?
Yeah. Well, that was. Well, see, that's the thing is that, you know, I mean, that because you had the same kind of situation. I mean, if you wanted to live in Destin,
it was stupid expensive because it's a touristy, you know, kind of thing, right? Other side of the bridge is more, you know, ex-urban, you know, hometown kind of thing, right? Okay, that's nice, except the toll goes from $1 a trip to like $3. All right. And by the way, that's with the transponder. Yeah. Without it, it's worse. And so, you know, and it's like, do you guys realize? And then, of course, this was when Sarah first went into the workforce. This was when the Obamacare stuff started to come in, where they wouldn't let you have more than 28 hours because, God forbid, you go over 32 and all of a sudden they get fined because they're not giving you health insurance, right? So, and they can't, they have to cut you off at like 28 because what if somebody calls out? All right, we need to be able to call somebody up and say, hey, you need to, you know, we need you to come in and take this shift. I can't do that if you're up against the 32-hour wall without the company getting fined. So they always, you know, management is not stupid. They take this into account. And as a result, they're cutting you off at 28 hours.
A lot of what these people are doing, though, somehow or another, I mean, as Eric has been on a while, but his idea of the management class, I mean, all this stuff is supposed to be a savings of some kind, Carl, but it's not. The tolls here, they use the excuse of COVID to get rid of all the people who took the cash money if you walked up and you want to pay cash.
Yeah.
So you can't pay cash. Okay, now, the idea is there's going to be this big savings. Well, now, if you're an absolute dummy from the South Side like me, you'd say, okay, if there's a savings, the toll used to be $1, either next time it doesn't go up or maybe it should go down to 90 cents. Cause
right. But, of course, that's not what
happened. But if it goes into the savings, it goes into the bonus for the guy who runs the toll road. Right. Where's the savings to me, necessarily? we're you know, hey, we're all doing good. Who's we? You got a mouse in your pocket?
Exactly. except all the people who, you know, who you would think would get some of that, right? They don't get any of it.
No, you don't get, you know, this whole idea of we're all doing great. Well, you know, who is we? I mean,
well, that was, well, it's like, you know, you guys were talking about like the stadiums and stuff like this. Well, I've, you know, gone to a couple of these ball games now at the, you know, the new Double A club stadium down in Knoxville, right? And well, I was there last night. There's a bar right near one of the entry gates. It's, you know, it's an Irish pub. It's okay. We went in there and we had dinner like an hour before the game. And you would have thought the play, I mean, you know, hey, the beer is half the price it is in the stadium, right? I mean, you think, right? No. I mean, did they have people in there? Yeah, it wasn't a ghost town, but you'd think the place would be slammed and it isn't. And the reason is that, oh, well, you know, it used to be that there was a nice municipal parking lot right there that was free. Now, all of a sudden, that ain't true no more. Now it's $20 to park your car because it's game night.
$20, wow.
Well, yeah, and then the other thing that they did to them is...
I thought the Sox were horrible at 30, but they're, at least they're, well, they're supposed to be Major League.
Well, these guys are supposed to be double.
Hey, how about we go on a break so we come back before the number comes out?
That sounds reasonable.
SP Futures down up 27, sorry. NASDAQ Futures up 97. We'll see if that changes. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jacks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 28, NASDAQ Futures up 100. As I mentioned earlier, we've got Lululemon down 20%, $66 on their earnings. And we have DocuSign down 20%, $18 on their earnings. So some of these earnings things have been kind of bizarre. Dow Futures are up 164 over in Europe. We've got, again, it's all going to change in a minute. So let's say the European stocks are kind of mixed. They're not doing much anything over in Asia. Nikkei was up 187.5%. Hang Seng down 114.5%. So not much there. Oil, we'll see what these guys are doing. Oil is oil's gonna make a move here in a second. Oil's down 3 cents, 63.34. We got gold up $6, 33.81. It's a weekly gain. Silver, whatever reason, we're gonna comment on Carl on this, over 13-year high. We actually had a huge day in silver yesterday for our people yesterday, the biggest day we've ever had. I mean, it's out of the blue. I'm like, is that a misprint on silver? But it wasn't. Foreign exchange, dollar weekly loss, 114 on the euro, 135 on the pound. What do you have for us, traffic, weather, sports, quick?
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:30 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. 61 degrees right now with a high of 68. Clouds and hazy sunshine today. So it will be mainly clear with a low of 56 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 78 degrees right now with a high of 103. Sunny and very warm. Tonight will be clear with a low of 76 degrees. Traffic in Chicago. Iman Kennedy from Monroe's 25 minutes. We're looking at 38 minutes. Iman Enos from Lane Cook. Iman Eisenhower from Wolf, 32 minutes. 23 minutes. Iman Den Ryan from 95th. Iman Stevenson from 294 to the Den Ryan, 29 minutes. Let's talk about sports real quick. Stanley Cup Final Game 2 is today. Panthers at Oilers, 7 p.m. Edmonton leading the series 1-0. NBA Finals Game 1. Pacers barely beat Thunder 111-110. Game 2 is this Sunday, June 8th at 7 p.m. Lastly, MLB yesterday. Diamondbacks beat Braves 11-10. White Sox beat Tigers 3-2. And Cubs beat Nationals 7-1. Today we got Diamondbacks at Reds, 6:10 p.m. Cubs at Tigers at 6:10 p.m. as well. Finally, Royals at White Sox, 6:40 p.m. Back over to you guys.
So, Carl, you got him already? I haven't gotten him yet. What do you got?
Yeah, I got him. So the official crooner number is plus 139. As you probably saw, the futures spiked up a little. I mean,
yep.
They're
cooking up.
Well, now they're kind of coming. You know, of course, a little bit softer number means that the Fed will cut rates, right? Which is why, you know, the market would take off. Here's the thing, though. All right, so I mean, like that's the headline. Now I got to go punch in my, you know, my stuff, right? In order to actually get something real. So this will take me a minute, and just from looking at this. You know, eyeballing it while I'm punching it in, it looks like we're down 600 unadjusted. But give me just a second here, and I'll.
I got us down on my sheet here. I got us down 700,000 jobs.
I'm down 642, I think. But let me.
That's kind of a number, and I got the unemployment is up 80,000. How is the rate the same?
Well, here's okay. So now I got the.
I got 600,000 people less in the labor force. What's that all about?
Well, yeah. So I just got the pickup of the three, you know, the three numbers off that table A1, not seasonally adjusted, which is of course, you know, where I pick them up from. So the gross change number on the employed is down 642, neg 642. The annualized is plus 2 million, 2.06. Now, it was, the annualized number is plus 2.45 last month, so that ain't such a good thing, right? The not in labor force is up 595, so basically all of the losses were people that couch surfed, that went to couch surfing.
Yeah, everyone just traded columns, but how did the... Right. How did the unemployment rate...
So essentially, you just moved it from one to the other, right?
All right, my math here, I'm still halfway decent at math. We got 163 million people working, 164, 7.1 million, 7.2 unemployed. Now we've got 163.2 employed, and we actually went up the number of unemployed. How does the unemployment rate stay the same? Who's doing
well,
the math?
Well, it's knob twisting nonsense. But I'll tell you, there's... We've got another problem here. I've been talking about this one for a while, which is it's been going on for over a year. It's the population-adjusted employment change, okay, which is essentially the delta. So it's the 12-month delta between employed less the growth in the non-institutional population, right? Because if you add a million people to the non-institutional population, you have to add a million jobs in order for the balance to stay the same.
Right.
All right. So that's the, you know,
And this is on a 12-month run rate basis, and that takes the seasonal variation out of it because, you know, Christmas comes at the same time every year and all that nonsense. Here's the problem, though, is that so this has been a negative figure going all the way back. Let's see, when did it go negative? It went negative in 2023, May of 23. But it kind of floated around in the minor negative area and had a positive read in November of 23, you know, right around for the Christmas season, you know, because people hire for the, you know, for that and stuff. But it's been negative on a continual basis now for almost, well, basically a year and a half. And it is now accelerating in the wrong direction, and on a 12-month run rate basis, it's -3.377, which is materially beyond the 12-month change in the positive direction from the from the the working age population. So we've got and by the way, I don't know that I've got a -3.3. Other than like in the middle of the COVID crazy stuff in 20 and 21, yeah, I don't have a number that.
And my dummy page I'm looking at here, that's a number that pops right out at me. Last month we had 60% of the people available to work working, and this month we're down to 59.7.
It's big, and that's, I mean, but this
I've never seen that kind of a move.
Well, this sort of deterioration is exactly what we saw in the start of the blow up in 08.
I don't see a number that low.
And of course,
in COVID.
It got a lot worse. Okay.
Yeah, I don't see a number that low. It's a little bit lower in COVID. 2020 was 56.8, but that only a little bit.
Well, but this pattern of deterioration that we've now had going on for a year. Okay, I noted starting in the first months of 07, all right, before the housing market actually cracked and exploded. I mean, you know, 07, you know, January of 07 was before, you know, everybody was still rah, 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 everything's fine, right? No, it wasn't, according to the labor market. And then, of course, it got worse. And then, you know, what happened in after Lehman blew up and all of that, then everything went totally down the toilet in, you know, September, October, November, and from there on. We are, from this figure, and as I have long said, I've said this for 25 years, if there's one number you look at in as a time series, it's not something that gives you a, you know, a 30-second warning kind of thing. But the trend on this is, if you ignore this, you're crazy. It is the employment versus the, you know, 12-month run rate, that versus the non-institutional population. With that back.
I don't think we can balance any budget, state or federal, if that number is not 62 or 3 and it's under 60.
Well, it's yes, and you lost three ticks there this month.
How could we, the only 2 months anywhere along here that are lower than that are the 2020, 2021.
This internal rate of change figure has, you know, obviously COVID was a sudden shock, right? That came out of the middle of nowhere. No one knew it was coming in advance. Well, maybe a few people did in like October and November, but, you know, it didn't make it into the market's consciousness, let's put it that way, or the labor market or anything else. The 07 thing was totally different. It did. It was there. It was very clear. The data was on the table for anybody who was looking at it. I was talking about it back then. And, you know, poo, you're crazy, nothing bad.
2007 was 63.
I understand that. We came from a higher plateau, as you say.
We did actually go down below 59 in 2010 and 11.
Yeah, it's this is a very troubling series right here.
By the way, I knew you were going to talk about this, so they have a new, this U.S. debt clock now continues to expand. In fact, there's a couple things here that I absolutely don't even understand. But what is USA total interest savings per year? Immense savings from the elimination of the fractional reserve banking system. What the hell is that? I have no idea what. Anyway, the one for you, they're doing this 2000 as their base year. U.S. workforce now, 164.1 million. Is it close to what the number you're looking at?
U.S. workforce.
Workforce now, 164 mil. Anyway, they got U.S. workforce 2000, 163.9 mil. Okay, so workforce hasn't changed much according to these guys. But this is what you're talking about. Not in the labor force now, 102.2 million, which is pretty close to what's on the A1, right?
I got 103, but they're off
102
by
point.
This just came out. Yeah, it was 102.5 last, 102.6 last month.
Right, so these guys got 102.3, so who knows where they're at. But what you're talking about, in 2000, that number was 84. So
right.
We're talking 18 million people that aren't doing something that some, well, maybe they're retired and got their own dough. That's possible. But they might also be people that the other people have to support.
That's right.
And that's a problem.
Well, yeah, and this is and again, as I've said, if you want you want one number, it's the employment population ratio is the one you look at, right? That's the one number that tells you what the tax balance looks like within the within the government, revenue versus expenditures, et cetera. It's the revenue side, because people that aren't doing anything, don't have any money, don't pay taxes. So that's the there you are. But I am very this 12 month run rate adjusted number. I'm telling you right now, you may not be able to hear the train or see the train coming, but the crossbars are lit up and the gates down. And if you want to stand on the tracks, or even better, park a semi over the top of them, you go right ahead and do that.
Why do you? There's a lot of questions that this all brings up. And
by the way, the employment population ratio in all groups except less than high school diploma cratered this last month. They were all down four ticks. High school graduates were down three ticks, but everybody else was down, including associate's degrees and bachelor's, down four ticks. People are being fired.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. Well, I told you about the advertising company that when we clients work for, they laid off 11,000 people after a merger.
Well, it's here in the data.
Yeah.
Okay. People are being fired. It's the data says very clear, and it is people. It is not the dropout, the high school dropout that's being fired. It is people with college degrees.
When you you go to the store and you're wandering about the city, I'm sure you do. I do a lot of that, and it used to be easy. You looked at the best looking girl in the place, right?
Right.
Well, now maybe because of stocks and jocks and because all the stuff we're always talking about, I can't help but look at all the rest of the people, like in the food store and wherever. Not so much if we got to dinner on Friday night or something, or Saturday night, everybody there looks pretty good. But if you go into, like, Audrey loves hot dogs, and right. So, by the way, do you truck with there were two huge studies years ago, and they both came out with the exact same result, that if you were to say to somebody, it's your last meal, do you want a hot dog or a hamburger? The person who says a hot dog is more likely to be an extrovert, and the person who says a hamburger is more likely to be an introvert. You ever read that?
Hey, that sounds kind of weird.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't... Well, Audrey's a full extrovert, so it works for her. She'll take a hot dog any day. But if you go to these places that are kind of off and you look around, you almost have to, if there's 20 people in there, you almost can't even imagine what job 15 of them have. The people that look like they're probably 50 look like they're 70. You can't imagine anybody who... everybody looks like they're sick. There's something. I don't know if it's the health care. I don't think they're all just smokers or whatever. But I mean, and then you contrast that with we talk a lot about the immigration here, people here are illegal, that kind of
right.
thing. And then you hear Bill Moriarty talking about some of the best workers that you have at these big projects are all people. I mean, they didn't just swim across the river, but maybe they don't have. A green card, but you get a social security number, obviously you're paying them, because they're like your best workers. They work hard, they're healthy. I mean, somewhere along the line, we got to get our hands around all of this. I think, count on.
Yeah, we do, and it's a very serious problem, Chief, because you know there's a study, and I mean this is in one specific area of medicine, but there's a paper that came out fairly recently that I looked at, and I haven't written an article on it yet, but I've talked about this so much that it's like, okay, how many times do I say the same thing? I'm just like banging my head against the wall, right? And it's that out of the drugs approved for cancer over the last 20 years, so this is not just a, you know, last few year thing, the last 20 years, the majority of them, and I think the actual number was close to two-thirds, did not actually either improve quality of life or extend life. Yet they got approved. And the way they got approved...
But they are expensive. They got that going for them.
Oh, well, they're very expensive.
Yeah.
So, you know, so... And so all this money gets spent, but at the end of the day, all it does is transfer funds from someone to someone else, all right? And the thing is that the FDA has allowed this based upon surrogates, so they're not supposed to do this, all right? This is part of the corruption that is endemic within our society today. They allow the approval to go through because, for example, you have a tumor, you take this drug, you get an MRI 2 months later, the tumor is smaller, okay? Therefore, we let the drug be approved, okay? Even though the drug costs, you know, $200,000 for a course of treatment or whatever it
is.
Okay, the problem is the drug has enough toxicity and side effects and things like this that neither your quality of life nor the amount of time you live changes.
Well, that's right, yeah.
So in other words, it didn't truthfully do you a damn bit of good.
Right. As much as, okay, you think it might have, it doesn't. It hasn't.
As much, yeah. And then the problem is, if they try to take this thing off the market later on, everybody and their brother that took it screams, "Well, I'm alive, and I would have been dead." But of course, the data says that's not true. All right, and yet that's what happens. And the backlash is so insane that, for the most part, these things never get withdrawn. All right,
and they never come down in price.
Well, of course not. When the patent expires, they've got another one in the pipe that does the same thing, right? So the thing is that we have this, and it's not just in healthcare; it's everywhere throughout the economy. But in healthcare is where, you know, we can actually look at it scientifically and say the data does not support what you did. This is a scam. We can analytically look at it and say it's a scam. I mean, like the thing with EVs. And, you know, and Tesla and the tax credits. I mean, the one thing Elon is very good at is he's a great tax farmer. That's his greatest attribute. So how he made all his money.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
Yeah, and he's still doing it. And the reason he's all pissed off is because I think he believed that by getting involved with the government, he would protect his tax farm. And that didn't work out for him. So now he's mad.
Well, he also, he took a... I think, and I don't, you know, I don't have an ego like any of these guys, so I can't even judge him. But,
well, me too.
But I think in the one hand is he. People don't like. I'm not going to compare him to Elliot Spitzer because I really kind of liked him, but even if people see something wrong, they don't necessarily like the reformer. It's an odd thing about human beings, but they don't. I mean, I knew people that. Couldn't stand the specialist they traded with on the New York Stock Exchange. Thought the guy was a total crook. And when Elliot Spitzer brought him up on charges, they were mad at Spitzer. It's not his business. You know, kind of a thing.
It's a weird
dynamic humans have. But
yeah.
Anyway, but I think to a certain extent, just stupid opinion here, because I got three real good questions for you I'm lined up on.
I'm looking at the internals on this data while we're talking.
He's a guy that took a pretty reasonable personal hit from doing this stuff in the Doge.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a fan, but, you know, people are keying his customers' cars.
Right.
And people don't want him, you know, whatever. I mean, he took a personal hit. He became like the face of the most unpopular man in the country.
Well, the thing that I think is interesting is that Tesla's went from being a virtue signaling thing for anybody that was an environmentalist to being the devil incarnate.
Yeah. So now
within a day.
Well, now the dude's smart enough to read this bill and go, they just pissed away more than I saved, and I'm public enemy number one. What kind of deal is this?
Right.
All right. So put your money manager in head for a second. What's a money manager to do today? These numbers came out a little bit light. So the market is celebrating yet again because we're going to get this rate cut like the European Union did, which is insane. Why you got to go down to 2% in interest, I have no idea. But yet, the interest, the 10 and 30-year rates are shooting to the moon here. The 30-year, 30-year's up.
You kind of noticed that the TNX is, the curve is steepening and not a little. Right.
Well, one of these days, I think it's going to break through this 4.5%, right back up there, 4.46. 30 years at 4.94. It's made it near 5 a couple times. I don't know if it breaks through hard one day, but the market is absolutely convinced there's going to be more money, so higher stock prices, and yet the bond market's telling you if you play that game again, you're going to get more inflation and the long-term rates are going to go straight up. So who's right?
Well, I'll tell you, in the short term, you know, in the casino today, it looks like the stock market says, you know, the NAS is good for 180 handles on the futs right now, right?
Every day. It's up a percent a day, every day.
Yeah, and you know, the ES is currently sitting plus 46, all right?
How much more can we drive this meta up? It's up another $9 today.
To go back to the productivity and cost thing, because it interconnects with the employment numbers. And it also interconnects with the general state of the economy. And that is that the overselling of the so-called benefit that AI is going to bring, I think we are very close to a knee point where this thing blows up in everybody's face. And I don't think this has much more runway to go. I don't know exactly what's going to set it off, just like I didn't know precisely what was going to set off, you know, that... You had the two little hedge funds in 2007 that blow up.
What about 2000? Well, all of a sudden, one day, all this stuff is overpriced by 80%.
I was actually house hunting in Florida the day that the NAS cracked. And what cracked it was MicroStrategy came out and said that they were restating earnings right after they had massively beat expectations. And I mean, they were a little dog squeeze company. Okay, in the NASDAQ, they didn't mean anything in terms of market cap.
You also had a different tone in the Federal Reserve. They put...
Well, I understand that, but I'm saying they came out and made that announcement, and all of a sudden the NASDAQ explodes. And the thing is, I mean, if you looked at that objectively, you'd say, that company doesn't mean anything. They're not even in the top 20.
You look at Cisco. It was trading 65, went down to 7, and you looked at it, their revenue per share was $6. They were 11 times... And a lot of these companies are way bigger than Cisco ever was, and they're all over 10 times revenue, which is my danger zone. And yet they've been there so long, what's the point of even saying it anymore?
Well, one of the points that I made the other day is that we have a tremendous amount of inertia in America in terms of our markets, in terms of the ship, just the size of the ship, right? It's an aircraft carrier, and that has been to our benefit in terms of being able to do things that you would think there is no possible way they get away with, right?
Yeah.
They do get away with it. Well, the problem with inertia is it cuts both ways, okay? It takes 10 miles to get that train up to speed, and it takes 10 miles to stop it. And so when we hit this, and the negative feedback starts, and again, you're seeing it in the productivity and cost numbers, and I think a significant part of that, because it's all on the services side, it's not on the goods manufacturing side, it's all on the services side. When that gets into people's consciousness, and I think a lot of this is the actual negative impact from AI, which I believe is much larger than people are, everyone's trying to sweep it under the rug. Well, you just had this company that Microsoft put a huge
huge pile of money into. The entire thing was a fraud. They had a bunch of guys over in India that were writing the code answers.
Yeah.
It wasn't AI at all. And of course, the instant that gets exposed, the entire thing blows up. But this went on for several years without being exposed. Like, this wasn't something that they did, and then 3 months later, the cat gets out of the bag. This went on for a long period of time. And I look at like what has happened with search. When you go and you Google something, and Google has essentially displaced the first page of results halfway down the page.
Yeah.
Because they've got their AI thing at the top.
Yep.
All right. Well, that has destroyed the AdSense advertising revenue as well, because now you have to go partway down the page to see it. All right. Well, guess what? That reduces the click-through rate, which reduces the value, which reduces the payouts. And I see it on my side because I have some of their advertising running on some of my articles, not on all of them. And part of that is because they've blackballed, 80% of what I want to talk about. So I can't put it on that side where it's advertising supported, or they'll throw me off the platform. So they've double screwed the people on the other end. And then they add this to the top of it, destroying the value of it. And half the time the answers this AI gives you are wrong.
Well, I mean, I got to ask you my uranium question, but I got a minute for that. Let me.
Yeah.
But on the Tesla thing, I think everybody knows that I have a whole lot of clients that I do some stuff for, and I think most of them are pretty happy. Some I think are real happy. And if those that aren't happy aren't telling me. Let's put it that way. But a couple of people called yesterday on Tesla. Tesla's down 50 some bucks.
Yeah,
and it's and this kind of comes into the 2000 fiasco. When things get pretty high up, the gentleman says, where do you think we should put a bid in for Tesla? Now maybe on the bottom last night, it's up $8 today, and maybe we could have caught a few shekels here. But I look at the PE ratio, and I see 157, and I go, I'm not so sure that if somebody offered me this stuff at 150, I'd say, and again, don't sell Tesla on my account. I'm not so sure if somebody told me it was half this price that I would be all over it. I'm not predicting any kind of a crash, because boy, the way it sure as hell hasn't crashed in a long time, and it's sure not going to do so if I think it's going to. And I'm not positioned that way or anything, but I'm protected. If it does crash, my guys are going to lose way less than everybody else. But there's a cost to that. You have to pay for insurance. But I'm not so sure that. If Meta is trading $694, if you told me tomorrow I'll sell you all you want at $300, I'm not so sure I'm a buyer. These companies are way too big. They have these valuations. It's one thing for a
Chief,
growing.
I didn't understand the argument for that company at 50 a share.
Yeah. Well, now it's. You'd still rather be long.
obviously, yeah, yeah. But I'm just saying, I didn't understand that. Okay, and now, it's 10 times.
Yeah. Hey, well, I look up Meta's PE. The rage now is buying uranium stuff. I had to listen to some guy talk my ear off last night, basically about that. Now, everybody's going to go nuclear, and I go, there's no nuclear plant even going up now. The last one came online, right? Anyway.
Well, exactly.
So, but there has been a run-up in these. There was a run-up, obviously, in the Bitcoin, which I think is kind of a fake stock. But still, gold has finally started to make some kind of a move. Now, silver is doing a huge catch-up the last couple of days, much to the benefit of my clients. But all of a sudden, these uranium stocks are moving. Is there any? I know the Three Mile Island's coming back on, and the one across in Michigan might be coming back on. But is there all the stuff you've talked about? I explained to this guy last night. I go, hey, I got a guy on my show that knows all about this crap. This guy named Carl. And, oh, by the way, I'm talking to him tomorrow. And he's been talking about these small reactors, the sodium ones and all this stuff that we should be doing, the Breeder reactor that Jimmy Carter, bleep canned. I said, we should be doing all this stuff. But the fact is, we're not.
Right.
Do I think we would, from what I've learned from Carl, do I think that we should start tomorrow? Yeah. I mean, what the hell? Why wouldn't I think that? But I don't see any movement here maybe the uranium stuff was down so low that any movement to the upside, you know, those plants coming back online is enough to goose them. Maybe it's just inflation. Maybe it's a dollar going down. I don't know. But I said, you know what, I'm going to ask Carl tomorrow morning. Is there any reason that you can see, as much as you're all for this, to run out and buy uranium today?
No, and but not because I don't think there should be. Because I think there should
well,
be.
Well, yeah, kind of with you on
okay.
that.
Okay, right. But the problem is that without a closed fuel cycle, fission energy is a self-limiting thing that eventually you're screwed. Because if I'm running a reactor, I have to put the spent fuel somewhere, right? I've got a finite amount of space. And the only and eventually I'm going to run out, at which point I've got trouble. So there has to be an answer to that problem, or else, you know, you fill the pool, the spent fuel pool up.
Well, does the sodium ones you're talking about, do they spit off the same amount of crap?
Which ones now?
Like the sodium salt ones you're talking about, or
so the liquid salt ones, the advantage you have with them is that, now we didn't get this part of the engineering done, so again we've got R&D to do if we actually want to do this. You could online reprocess essentially the fuel. In other words, you can separate out the low isotope stuff that has a short half time, you know, short half life. It degrades relatively rapidly. That's the stuff that ultimately you can ship off the site. You really don't care, right? Because we can, you know, okay, it's dangerous for 100 years. We can probably manage that. The stuff that's dangerous for 100,000 years is a different story. But the thing is, you have to be able to separate those things out. You leave the 100,000-year stuff in the reactor, gets burned up, and over time, and it releases a little bit of energy, but that's not the reason you leave it in there. The reason you leave it in there is it gets reduced down in its danger level over time by being left in. But you have to, somehow with a conventional reactor, you have to take the fuel pins out because their fuel gets depleted. In a liquid salt reactor, the fuel is actually in the carrier, so you can add more to it without having to shut it off. That is the one thing, by the way, that China says they've now demonstrated being able to do, is online.
Well, what's
fuel
he talking about? This one is like the size of a house or a room or something.
Okay, those are small modular reactors, and they're very conventional in terms of their inside design. Okay, they're not using this kind of technology.
So they're gonna have garbage left, garbage out.
They'll run for their 5 years or their 10 years or whatever their fuel load runs for. But then you literally pick it up with a crane, you put it on the back of a truck, and the entire unit gets taken somewhere where it's dismantled and the fuel is taken out of it. The problem with that is they generate just as much high-level waste and just as much trouble in that regard as does a huge, you know, boiling water reactor, you know, the great big things that we use today. The difference is, of course, it's less of it because it's smaller. Well, duh.
Yeah.
Right? But in terms of the actual mix of waste, it's the same.
But you don't see any reason. We actually put on a little spread yesterday. One of the uranium companies, it's a small company, but very small spread, and not really all that bullish. Just, you know, kind of get in. So you're not saying there's no reason around to buy all these things today.
I think this is just it's you know, spin the wheel hype machine stuff right now. And part of the problem is anything that comes out of an administration, whether you agree with it or not, and I do, that we should be doing this kind of thing, is absolutely worthless when you've got 20 and 30 year payback amortization schedules, and the next guy that comes along, whoever it is, could turn around and nuke it, just like has happened so many times before. And so this, in order for me to get bullish about that sector, you need to have congressional action that codifies that this is a path we're going to actually go down. And it is essentially impossible for a future administration to destroy it, because that's the only way you're going to get serious investment.
I would agree. Well, you know, I think a lot of this stuff is overvalued, Carl, but I cannot get short because of the money. It's not about the market; it's about the dollar.
You know, shorting parabolic spikes is a good way to die.
Yeah, and I think if we're going to go back to 8% money supply pouring in and lowering the rates like this guy wants to do, I think the market goes straight up, and I think inflation goes way up, and I don't know, it's going to end like it did in 1980. I never thought we'd do that again in my lifetime, for God's sake.
I think we're a lot closer to the end of the rope on that than we are at the beginning of it, and I don't know precisely what the, you know, what the tripwire is going to be. If I knew exactly when it was going to happen, boy, I'd have more S&P puts than you could shake a stick at.
Just,
right?
Just remember that when I started in 1980, 81, whatever it was, my first 18 months where the interest rates were to the moon, Alice, I thought the market was a buy because the interest rates had to come down because they couldn't stay there or we'd be going under. Yet it was 18 long months, and during that time, interest rates actually came down 4%, CD rates, and the market went down another 20%. It was after the handwriting was on the wall.
Right.
So don't ever get the ego that because you think the market's a tad high or some stocks are a tad high, that by noon everybody's going to read the same tea leaves and you can short the stock today and you'll be rich by this afternoon. Don't ever have that kind of an ego. I'm telling you, it doesn't work.
Well, you know, it's one of the things about being a trader is, if you cannot deal with the fact that you're wrong from time to time, and you're wrong a whole lot more than you'd like to think you are.
Well, you're early more than you're wrong.
Well, but that's still same
thing.
Wrong.
Same
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I mean, you'll run out of money before it goes the right way.
That's right. Hey, buddy, we'll talk on Tuesday. Have a nice weekend. SP futures up 46, NASDAQ futures up 170. However, we got the 30-year bonds up 1.5%, and the 10-year bonds almost up 2%.
Yeah, 10, so TNX is up 1.82.
Yeah, right, it's unreal. All right, back on. Good job, Ricky. Back on Monday, Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.